This week, we profess our own phony theology. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I have the pleasure to present to you now.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
to remind
process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. Now.
Welcome to episode 20. It is February 23rd, 2012. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob. We've made it to 20 episodes.
20 episodes. That is amazing, isn't it?
I don't usually stick with things this long.
We should have, I don't know, we should have had cake or something.
Celebrate. Virtual cake.
I want to welcome our new fans. We have we've had a flurry of new folks join us on Facebook this past week, so we want to say hi to all of them.
Hello.
Hello, new listeners. And if you're listening via iTunes, give us some love on iTunes. You can post a review or, at the very least, give us a 5-star rating on there.
It doesn't cost you anything to just click to the right.
That's right. Guess I'm being presumptuous, but that's okay. You can also email us your comments, of course, at feedback@midwestpeaceprocess.com. Or you can just comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/midwestpeace. And in a few weeks, we will have a new way for our fans to interact with us. We're going to be opening up a forum on our website. So there will be more details to come on that. This week, we are going to focus on the war on drugs. So we're gonna talk about that in just a minute. But first, I wanted to circle back to something we mentioned in last week's episode, the story about the chicken nuggets that we covered. It appears that entire story was just the result of a big game of journalistic telephone with the typical echo chamber that the internet sometimes is. And so I've got a link in the show notes to a story that was written by a blogger in North Carolina who was following the story. And from what I gathered, it wasn't like a federal agent who was inspecting school lunches and then made the kid eat chicken nuggets instead of what they brought. It seems that the core of the story was some graduate students who were just there at the school that day, and they were surveying the kids' lunches to collect data for their thesis or whatever in school. So, they were making notes of what the kids were eating, but they weren't forcing them to eat alternative things. So
how the hell did that story turn into what it was?
I don't know.
Maybe drudgereport.com?
Well, actually,
oh my God.
This guy points the finger at Rush Limbaugh in one particular instance, because when Rush reported the story, it had already involved a state agent of some kind in North Carolina. But then when Rush reported it, he further embellished the story and made it a federal agent who was, inspecting school lunches. So it just seems like, maybe one tiny bit of truth kind of chummed the waters, and then there was this feeding frenzy that turned it into this big non story.
I can't believe it, though. I mean, when I went to Drudge, it was right there. I mean,
Rob,
I got all fired up. I got all fired up about
it. I still don't get why you dislike that so much. The stories are not written by Matt Drudge.
No. Yeah, well, this is a good topic. Yeah, it's not Matt Drudge, right? It's just a link. He's just linking to it, but he's aggregating information that is meant to cause people to get angry in a certain way, and it bears no resemblance.
Why do you say to get angry in a certain way?
That's the point of drudge. Don't we all know what the point of drudge is? It's to get you fired up.
So what's the point of CNN? What's the point of CNN?
So we can look at Wolf Blitzer's beard.
What is the point of CNN? Or Fox CNN, News? Or your local news?
To report news. But
To report news.
That's right.
What's the point of Huffington Post?
To give us a top 10 list of most outrageous outfits. I don't know. I don't go to Huffington Post. Come on. Are we really saying that drudgereport.com is like just an unbiased aggregator of information?
No. I would say you're right, Rob.
Right.
It has a very obvious bias.
Right, and it's a purpose
to hide the bias.
Right. And the purpose is some of our listeners sent us some fantastic looking graphs and the lines go up and down, and there's acronyms.
Yeah,
but that's not going to get all that many hits. You know, you need that Drudge Report's all about that feeling of aha, I knew I was right about this. You know, I suspected this was going on, and sure enough, look, it is. Like that's the point of Drudge Report.
Yeah, well, but that's not peculiar to the right either.
No,
I mean,
no. It certainly
is. Left has their own echo chambers too. So
right. Just as long as we don't click on links and go like, ooh, look, there's aliens.
The moral of this story, of course, is don't believe everything you read on the internet.
Yeah, Jeremy.
No, if it's on the internet, it's true.
Right.
It's hard to get those bits and bytes on there.
Government wouldn't let them put false information on the internet, would they?
But that's the feeling. What's the point? I'll get it fired up here. I think a lot of the times this happens in a cycle. It's a little while loop, if you will, if you understand software. That's right. and the way the little loop goes, while true, you follow this loop. You something happens. You blow it out of proportion to get outraged, which then brings the feeling of aha, I knew I was right about this the whole time, and it gives you a pleasing feeling. And then the story gets debunked with lots of facts and details, which are so boring. You're like, whatever. You know it's true anyway. Pause, wait, sleep one, whatever it is. Oh, next issue comes out, you know, and then you repeat the same thing. Shirley Sherrod shows up with a video, and then it's all taken out of context, and she's vindicated. And then what happens? You wait.
Yeah.
You know, one day. Oh, it's the next conservative outrage, and then you come on to the next one. And then it gets debunked, and then there's no ending the cycle. It's wash, rinse, repeat.
Way to throw that conservative thing in there too. That was good.
Which part?
You're in your last statement.
What did I say? I don't remember.
Forget it. Moving on.
Oh, are you saying it's this outrage cycle is not unique to the conservatives?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
I think the conservatives are just better at it. We don't have an Andrew Breitbart pimp story, you know. We don't have a Shirley Sherrod video capture.
Well,
we just don't do it as well as you guys do.
The outlets within the mainstream media that kind of cater to the left, you know.
Okay.
Your MSNBCs and your
sure.
That's about the only thing I can think of, because there aren't that many. I mean, they're just, you know, to put it bluntly, they're not that popular.
Right, right.
There's a lot more out there coming from the right. You know, the content is being produced in much greater quantities from those sources on the right than it is
right.
on the left.
And it's fascinating that this whole episode too. It's fascinating that when the right does it, it's entertaining, but the right can't do funny. You know, the you remember Rush Limbaugh's comedy show or whatever it was. I'm not talking about his regular radio broadcast, which is full of comedy, but the half hour comedy hour or something.
No, I don't get that.
We'll get you a link. Well, they tried to do a satire show because they were getting outrun by the Daily Show and Colbert and
oh, yeah.
whatever else. So they tried their hand at like a like a late night Fox News conservative comedy thing, and it was awful. But like liberal outrage is just kind of whiny. You know, conservative outrage is entertaining. You know, it gets you fired up, stirs the passions.
Yeah.
But like the liberal outrage can't do entertaining, but conservatives can't do funny. Yeah. I stand by my claims.
Okay. All right. Well, this was not intended to be the war on Drudge. we're focusing on the war on drugs. And this came up in last week's episode, and we spent a little bit of time talking about it. But coincidentally, there were a couple of stories that came across my radar last week in conjunction with our last episode. So I thought this would be a good topic to maybe dive a little deeper into. And I've got links in the show notes to, first of all, the story we did discuss last week about drugs being decriminalized in Portugal and the effect that that's had on their drug abuse rates within their population. But then two other stories. One was on CNN asking the question, is Mexico's drug war strategy working? And the other one was a local story here in St. Louis regarding, here's the headline. White supremacist enlisted black gang member from St. Louis to help make meth.
Entrepreneurial. That's right. And an entrepreneurial
spirit.
Extending
the olive branch.
Yeah, that's right. The story leads off with, making methamphetamine also can make strange bedfellows.
That's good. Little twist.
Yeah, they've got mugshots of the two guys, and I'm thinking, you know, in the back of my mind, Ebony and Ivory is playing while I'm reading this. But the part of the story that's germane to this discussion, as far as I'm concerned, is the
goddamn Germans got nothing to do with it. Sorry, I had to throw in that smoke in the bandit quote. Anyway, sorry, go on.
the great lengths that they're willing to go to here in Missouri, and I'm sure there are other states, this can't be the only one, although Missouri has the rather dubious distinction of being the meth capital of the U.S., the great lengths they're willing to go to prevent people from buying the raw materials, you know, the pseudoephedrine. So, you know, they've already locked the state down as far as cold medicine, making it so that, you know, you basically have to register and give them a fingerprint and a retina scan and, you know, a DNA sample and everything else before they'll let you buy Sudafed. And now they're talking about making it a prescription only. But even worse than that, federal law, according to the story here, federal law permits purchase of 9 grams in a 30-day period and 108 grams per year. A pending bill in Missouri would drop those numbers to 7.5 and 75, respectively.
Why? I guess I don't know how much that is. What is the normal? How long would that last you if you really needed it for medical purposes?
Well, I think 9 grams is the amount of you know, the active ingredient in like one box of Sudafed, which is what, like 8 pills or 12 pills or something. So you can basically only buy one box per month.
Every 6? Okay.
And, you know, if you buy any more than that, then you get put on some sort of list and, you know.
That's just, that is not right. That is not the right way to go about it.
No.
What is the right way?
You let people buy what they need. And
well, how much do you need?
I don't know, because I don't use it.
Ooh, you should try it.
Druggy.
What are we talking
about? I think
now, meth or pseudo?
Yeah.
No, I really think there might be a little placebo effect. But yeah, when I pop those 2 Sudafeds, yeah, I get a little something. A little something going.
Okay.
You pop a couple before the show, or what?
All it's a little fired up
to do is clear your sinuses, but
actually, I will say that when I get a cold, I secretly hope it gets bad enough that I could hit the NyQuil.
I don't use that either.
That NyQuil's a hell of a drug.
All right, Rick James. Well, as luck would have it, this past Saturday, I was at dinner with friends, and a friend of mine, Jennifer, told a story about this, about once when she bought a package of Sudafed. And when she got out to her car, she opened up the package. It looked fine from the outside, but when she opened it, it was like some kind of quality control issue. One of the little things had two pills in it, and then a pill was missing and another one. So it looked like she couldn't tell if it was just poorly manufactured or if it had been tampered with or what. So she took it back in immediately, and they couldn't take it back, and they couldn't sell her anymore.
She fell into the black hole of Sudafed.
Yes, it was like the black hole of Sudafed.
Why wouldn't they take it back? I don't understand.
What would they do with it?
Well,
right, because there's probably some law that, because otherwise all the Smurfers, I think that's what it's called, smurfing, when you go around and buy a bunch of Sudafed from different places. Wouldn't they go and just like buy a bunch and then bring it back? Hey, this doesn't work. Hey, five of these are gone. Interesting, you know, and then they'd come back a week later and, hey, five of these are gone.
I see what you're saying. If they're missing from the box.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so there's a lot wrong.
I love that story. I picture the Sudafed like hovering in a gravitational field between the consumer and the seller. Neither can actually have the Sudafed.
There's a lot wrong with that. The whole system, the way it's set up right now. But, you know, this time of year especially is when I come to resent it the most because, you know, everybody gets colds. And, you know, sometimes, depending on how severe it is, you need cold medicine. And there's no reason you should have to go to a doctor and get a prescription for cold medicine.
Right.
I mean, there's no reason you should need a prescription for any drug, but, you know, especially this one. I'm just waiting for somebody somewhere to figure out how to make, you know, an illicit drug out of aspirin, you know, or Tylenol, or you
right,
know, and then suddenly
or water,
it cracked down. Yeah, right. People start sniffing oxygen, and we got to lock down the
They do, you know, the oxygen bars. You go there and
Have you ever? Have you guys ever been to one?
No.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah, right. You.
Yeah, I don't know what
you haven't. Oh, me neither. I didn't go last week.
No,
that's true. I mean, aren't we just in luck that it takes, you know, a certain type of cold medicine plus a bunch of like fertilizer that might blow up? You know, I mean, what's going to happen when someone can make it out of like dirt and rocks?
Yeah,
or something everybody wants. Like, what if you can make some sweet. Kind of amphetamine out of gasoline.
Yeah.
Well, they do. They use brake fluid is one of the things they use, isn't it?
So tasty.
So do they make you register when you buy a little bottle of brake fluid?
I don't know.
How do you hit up the meth? I don't even know.
This is the analog of...
You take a pill. I think, I don't know if you can shoot it.
And I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but
sorry.
It's just, you know, the escalation that we've seen by the TSA over the past decade. You know, of all the things that you can't take on an airplane, and you know, the more and more intrusive methods of searching people and their stuff when they go through security at the airport. You know, there was a story, I guess, I don't know, it was last summer maybe, about how certain terrorists were planning to have bombs surgically implanted inside their bodies so that, you know, they could get through security. And, you know, this is kind of the analog of that. It's like we're going to get to the point here where something that we all need to live every day is going to be classified as an illicit drug. And then what? You know, you have to ask yourself the question at that point. Do we continue on this logical path that we're on? Because it's leading us someplace that none of us can defend. Or do you finally just give up and say, okay, this is ridiculous. We should never have done this in the first place. Let's, you know, scrap the whole thing.
I have two things. One, back to what you said, Jerry, about no drug should require a prescription. I don't entirely agree with that. I think some drugs need for medicinal purposes, they need a little bit of control, and you need a little bit of guidance to use them. Some of the stronger drugs, maybe. And let me get the second thing out. I don't know if you want to talk about that anymore or not. But second thing regarding what you just said about everyday things that we need to live, the EPA did something similar by classifying carbon dioxide as a what classification did they give it? Like a dangerous pollutant.
Yeah.
And we everybody expels that every day.
Right.
Every time you breathe.
Oh.
What? Go ahead, Rob.
That's all I got.
Jeremy said something true. Look out.
it's the literal lamentation alarm that just went.
Oh, dear.
Makes me so weary.
Did the EPA not do that? Am I wrong?
Oh, jeez.
I think I know what you're talking about. I think it was the EPA wasn't allowed to regulate carbon emissions because it hadn't been classified as a pollutant, and they wanted to. I don't think they did. I could be wrong about that, but
I'll have to look that one up. Man, it's horrible if I'm wrong again. That'd be like three bogus things I've said in the last two episodes. Internet's going to bring me down.
It's just where you're looking on the internet.
I'm looking at MSNBC right now, and there's a link here, smoking pot tied to slacking off at work.
Well, so
looks like Rob's been token.
Well, that's, sure you're reading The Onion?
Yeah, you really need a scientific study for that one?
All right, back to what we were talking
about. Yeah, so that's that story. And, I mean, that is just one aspect of the war on drugs that irritates me personally, that, you know, we've gone overboard in regulating things that are just very tangentially related to drugs. And I'm just wondering how far we're going to take that before, you know, everybody just stops and says, what, really? Are you serious? We're not going there. But
one last thing. I got carded for buying a canister of air duster.
Oh, yeah.
At nice. Office Max or something like that.
Were you planning to huff it?
I huffed the hell out of that thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how carding me made them determine whether or not I was going to use it for the proper purposes or not.
No, they can't be selling inhalants to minors. So, you know, it's kind of like if you bought chewing tobacco, they'd have to card you for that too.
Yeah.
I'll give you some Occupy Wall Street idea on this whole thing. Like, is the idea? Let's just. Oh, here's a crazy thought. I don't know if I believe this, but maybe the point of why this is, say we're having increasing income inequality in the country. Okay, everybody say that. I said say that. No. But yes, let's assume that's happening, even though it is. But let's say that's happening, and people are going to have this urge to ingest substances that are possibly harmful, but also awesome. So, as the income inequality and the power structure changes, I mean, I could see these. I see it going the other way. I see laws like this increasing, because I think if you're super rich in your $1 million mansion and the cops come because you fell and broke your leg and you had to call them and, oh, there's a little got a little crack pipe. I don't know. Do millionaires smoke crack? They probably do.
Now, you call crack the cops when you break your leg? I don't understand.
Rich people do cocaine.
Rich people do cocaine. That's right. And rich people have a cell phone in their pants pocket at all times.
That's why the punishment for crack is, you know, three times worse, because we got to put the poor people in jail. We can't.
That's a whole separate thing. You're right. Mandatory minimums. Yeah. But yeah, you know, if you got to call the cops in your rich neighborhood and you're a mover and a shaker and old Johnny Blue comes in as the cop, you know, just trying to help you stand up, and he sees the little thing, that's going to be a little different than you know, if he's in the apartment complex or the slum or wherever else. You know, it's almost like these laws aren't, maybe they're not really quite for everyone.
No,
well, that's what the, that's with all laws. I don't think it's specific to drug laws.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you go back to, I want to say it's the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1934.
Oh, my God. Look at this guy with the facts.
I'd need to look that up. I might have that wrong. But anyway, I mean, that was one of the first federal laws in this country to regulate any kind of drug. And the impetus behind that law was racism, to put it bluntly. They you know, there was this urban legend that when blacks and Latinos would smoke marijuana, they would, you know, it's the whole reefer madness thing, they would become a danger to society. And so, you know, we've got to regulate this drug. You know, white people don't smoke that, so it's okay. We're gonna pass this law and impose this sanction on minorities in this country. But so,
what a silly law. They're dangerous without smoking that.
Nice. We're gonna get some mail over that.
And you're doing great. It's almost like there's a zero-sum game between Jeremy's claims and Jerry's. It is the Harrison Narcotics Act, but it was 1914. You missed it by 20 years.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, it regulates opiates and cocaine. How about that? Well, it was 1937 was the Marijuana Tax Act.
Okay, that's the one I was thinking of. But yeah, so I kind of conflated the two. But
how about that?
What does conflated mean?
Look it up.
Sorry. I'll take up a collection and buy you a vocabulary.
So what's the theme here? I don't think it's going to get worse. You think, come on, Jerry, your claim that some people are going to stand up and say enough's enough. I'm not seeing that.
I am. And it's happening. There's an organization called LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's all made up of either current or former law enforcement officers all across the country who have decided they're not going to enforce the drug laws anymore. And, you know, they recognize them to be what they are, unconstitutional. And so they're going to, you know, they're going to honor their pledge, their oath to support and defend the Constitution and ignore these laws that are repugnant to the Constitution. That's just one example. I mean, there are plenty, you know, name the laundry list of you know, pro-marijuana groups like NORML and MPP and, yeah, not the West Peace Process. This is the other MPP, Marijuana Policy Project. You know, there's plenty of organizations out there that are pushing for reform, pushing for decriminalization. And, you know, those numbers are growing and they're not going to stop growing until we finally reach a tipping point. And the problem is, and, you know, I think we talked about this in our little pre-show discussion before, but I'll bring it up again. The second story that I've got a link to is regarding the drug war in Mexico. And I think that the difference between this prohibition and the previous prohibition in this country was, back then, all of the bootleg alcohol was being made here in the United States. It was being transported by Americans. It was being bought and sold by Americans. And so all of the violence associated with that trade was happening right here on the streets of our country, and everybody saw it. But today, most of the drugs are being manufactured and transported elsewhere in other countries, Mexico in particular. And so all the violence is in those places. So people here in the U.S. are not being impacted as directly. And that's why I think it's taking longer this time for people to get on board and say, you know, this is pointless. Because, you know, the argument from a purely monetary standpoint is not as convincing as, you know, dead children in the streets. So,
do you think it also has to do with the reach of the laws, that on a given city block, how many people does it affect to have cocaine as a banned substance? Compare that to if alcohol were illegal.
I'm not sure.
My point is that maybe part of the, you're saying part of the public backlash was because the violence was in the streets of our country.
Right.
But I'm saying prohibition of alcohol had a larger impact than prohibition of drugs, because a lot more people just want to go have a drink compared to the number of people who want to do a few lines.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I can kind of see that, you know, from a purely economics or marketing standpoint, that, you know, maybe you have a much larger audience that are being offended when you try to ban alcohol. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is prior to prohibition, beer was pretty much all anybody drank in this country. You know, there was not a strong demand for hard liquor. It wasn't until prohibition that demand surfaced. And the main reason was it was easier to brew your own or distill your own spirits than it was to brew your own bootleg beer. And plus it was more concentrated, so you didn't have to drink as much to get drunk.
Yeah.
And, you know, so now, you know, if you could make the case that the problems we have in this country with alcoholism today are rooted in prohibition. That, you know, we spawned this market for hard liquor in this country that didn't previously exist. The same can be said of drugs, too. I mean, you know, methamphetamines would not exist in this country if we hadn't banned all of the natural drugs, you know, things that are derived from, you know. Marijuana does not make your skin turn black and your teeth fall out. You know what I'm saying? Methamphetamine is something used to clean your, you know, clean your wheels on your car or something. You should not be ingesting that.
But I can't disagree with that.
And, you know, we talked about this on a prior episode, but it you know, that has its roots in designer drugs that started back in the 80s, and that was, you know, that was chemists that were deliberately trying to get around the published list of illicit drugs that, you know, the DEA had. And so it became an arms race. You know, the DEA would add a drug to the list, and the chemists would just say, oh, okay, well, here's the chemical formula for that drug, so I'll just tack on another methyl group, and now this one's legal. You know,
mm-hmm.
So I've designed it to be legal. And they'd sell that one for, you know, 3 or 6 months on the streets, and then, you know, the government would retaliate by adding that chemical formula to the list. And, you know, it just went back and forth. And so you got these, you know, I don't know, these crazy drugs that don't exist in nature, that man has created, and they're dangerous. Way more dangerous than natural drugs. And you can blame the government for that.
Well, the government has a pretty good track record. Anytime they try to fix something, they make it worse and cause more problems.
Right.
Well, when did, you know, when Coca-Cola took cocaine out of their soft drink recipe?
I believe that was 1914.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty early as far as I know. But it was in there, it was like a stimulant.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that was one of their selling points. That, you know, it would clear your sinuses if you had a cold. It was, you know. Yeah, there was something, I'll have to look it up. There was a story on This American Life a few months back where they were talking about the formula for Coca-Cola. And
oh yeah.
And how one guy claimed he'd you know, he finally found it, that it had actually been published in a newspaper like 80 years ago or something, and he found it. And but then they went into another kind of side story that I thought was interesting, that, you know, that Coke, they still use the coca leaves in the process of manufacturing it, but they have to remove the cocaine from it. And there's like, this is real. Like one,
so they're dumping that into the water supply.
There's like one company in the country that's authorized to import coca leaves for that purpose. And that's all they do is they remove the cocaine from those leaves and then they pass them along to Coca-Cola so that they can use them.
Yeah. What do they do with the cocaine?
I don't know. I mean, it's probably, you know, it doesn't come out in a form that's usable by anybody. It's probably just green slush or something, and they just flush it down their toilet or whatever. But
yeah, and one of the fun parts of that story was they had some of the coke experts and the people who have had the 80-year-old recipe and. You know, then he would taste this guy's recipe and be like, yeah, it's nothing like that. Like, they were going to go like, you nailed it, you know?
Right. Well, to the, I don't know where the discussion is right now about the war on drugs, but what should happen in its place? So everything is now legal.
Yeah.
And then so make the assumption that we're going to have an initial increase in addicts.
Okay.
True or false?
Maybe.
So then you get to Portugal's model where they're now using funding to rehabilitate people.
Uh-huh.
Not sure where I'm going with this, but
well, play it out. That's where you're going.
Well, okay. So the DARE program was an attempt not at rehabilitation but prevention.
Right.
But I think they've taken that out of a lot of schools partly due to lack of funding, but partly due to it's not working.
Right.
Right. Well, yeah, I think they thought the program was sound and had scientific backing, and you know, I think they were doing it right, but then they would look at the data of did it actually help people stay off whatever it was, and it didn't. So it's a nice idea though.
Nice idea, but it didn't work.
Didn't work. I don't
probably
mind.
Along the lines of maybe it's a little better formulated than Nancy Reagan's "Just Say No" campaign. That was.
It's kind of like the countries that, you know, let kids drink, like the drinking age is, you know, 13 or whatever.
Right.
They don't have problems with alcoholism in general in those countries.
Right.
And so it's, you know, there's that psychological aspect of, you know, you're being denied something. You're being prevented from doing something, which just makes you want to do it all the more.
Right.
So I wonder, you know, what percentage of people who are active drug users or addicts are that way because of that. You know, they got into it initially because it was forbidden. You know, that made it made it attractive, and they're hooked, and now they can't get out of it.
Yeah, like Taco Bell. Like, what if Taco Bell was illegal? Man, I would have like soft tacos, you know, hidden in my basement. I'd put them in the attic, the floorboards.
Right.
But now, what if you get caught sitting in the parking lot, you know, moshing on a grand burrito or whatever it's called? You know, you just look like a loser. But it's so tasty in my own house. Fascinating.
Yeah, that's
it's like Taco Bell. Maybe we should outlaw tacos. Too tasty for the public. One thing it gives you is like it totally gives a free pass to the employers, because I'm not sure about this, but I thought in the Netherlands when I was there, there was some kind of government propaganda or advertisement for those in the military to stay off the weed, because I don't think they let them smoke the weed if you're active duty military, which is fine. But if you're not active duty military, you know, just toke it up. And so it's kind of interesting that it gives a free pass to employers. Like, they don't have to set a specific, you know, policy about don't toke up the weed. Because it's you know, federally illegal, but I think what you would find if it was federally legal, I bet a bunch of companies would say, sorry buddy, you can't do it anyway because we're gonna drug test you anyway as part of the, as an employee.
Yeah, because you don't want a bunch of high whacked out people doing work for you, slacking on the job.
Who got that anyway?
Yeah. Maybe we need some cocaine around offices. Get people moving. Get some things pushed through a little faster.
Get it going.
Improve productivity.
Yeah.
You get some awesome ideas, too.
Yeah. I
think. You know, we always say we got to think outside the box.
Right. Some awesome ideas.
Write them down so you remember them when you're off the coke.
What about a certain drug makes it illegal? Caffeine, some people consider that a drug. It's a stimulant.
It's
why?
Not some people. That's chemistry. It is a drug. So is alcohol. Yeah. Is it okay? Is that those are government approved drugs? Right?
Well, right. Or you could say natural drugs, but why is a
but
bag
cocaine's a natural drug?
Right.
Yeah. Cocaine, heroin.
Heroin.
So go on, put your Nostradamus hat on, or Nostradamus if you prefer. What's going to happen? What's the prediction? It's 2012. We got medical marijuana laws kind of sprinkling about the states right now.
Right. Well, 2012 is significant, I think, cuz this is 40 years, right, since the war on drugs began.
I didn't know that. I wasn't going to celebrate it or anything.
Yeah, it was Nixon formed the what's the name of it? The commission that was supposed to study the problem of, you know, of drugs and drug addiction in the country and then make some recommendations. And they went off and did their study and they came back and they said, yeah, you know, it's not really that big a problem. We probably don't need to worry about it. And so he ignored the commission and went ahead and, you know, passed all these laws anyway.
Good job.
Yeah. So, okay, you know, at its core, the most fundamental issue in it for me is the constitutionality of these laws. And we haven't really talked about this yet, but, you know, the original prohibition required an amendment to the Constitution because Congress at that time recognized the fact that they did not have the power to ban a substance without amending the Constitution first. And, you know, here we are almost 100 years later, and what happened? I mean, was Congress wrong back then, or has everybody since then just said, well, we're not going to bother with that. That's too inconvenient. We're just going to pass a bunch of laws and, you know, make this stuff illegal.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, I think so too. But, you know, nobody seems to be talking about that. And, you know, when we get you hear the public discourse on drugs, and you never ever hear anybody who's not a libertarian
right
say, hey, what's up with this? You know, these laws are clearly unconstitutional. Anybody can see that. You don't need to be a lawyer to make that determination. That fascinates me that, you know, nobody makes that connection. So I'm talking to our listeners now. All of you that are listening out there, that's the deal, okay? All the drug laws are unconstitutional. The entire war on drugs is unconstitutional. And we've wasted billions of dollars and killed thousands of people in this country over drugs.
And other countries.
And other countries, yes. So it's time to end this.
Hear, hear.
All right. I'm going to get down off my soapbox. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we will dig into some listener feedback because we got quite a bit from our last episode or two. So stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back. Okay, we had time to consult Wikipedia, and the commission that I was trying to think of is called the Schaefer Commission. They issued their report to Congress in 1972, March of 1972. So we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of that.
We'll have a party on that day.
Yeah. So let's talk about our listeners. Yeah. Let's talk about our listeners' comments. Listener Tim says, great episode. Jeremy gets more negative each week, or maybe he's more realistic. You mentioned, you mentioned and played the clip of Debbie Squire's comments. As a parent, I definitely feel I should be able to decide what is best for my child. But she may not be totally off base. There are a lot of kids out there where the parents really don't know what is best for their children. They don't pay attention to their children, don't teach them, and don't promote or facilitate learning. Without public education, these kids really wouldn't stand a chance. I don't like giving handouts, and I also know some of these kids are going to go down the wrong path even with guidance. But how do we save, quote-unquote, kids that are in situations like these if we don't have a public education system? Your thoughts?
I say I know how Jerry would respond. that we maybe we do need to save these kids, and I certainly agree with the listener that, that not all parents are well equipped to educate their kids as maybe some others are. But I think the issue that a Jerry would say would be that it's not a government responsibility to save these kids. There's nothing constitutionally mandated, and there's no clear guidance for the government to go in and save kids from their own parents. And if it's the government, then it's also going to be someone else's money. So the complaint is, why should my money go to an inefficient system to save kids that you didn't ask me whether I wanted to save them or not?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yay!
So what does Rob say? He said that's what Jerry would say.
What do I say?
Go ahead, Jeremy. You say what you think Rob would say.
Save them all. Let's hold hands and sing to them.
It's for the children.
It's for the kids, man. They should all get equal everything.
Children, I don't, for future.
Not again.
I agree with the listener that I think it's sadly unrealistic to expect in our society that all parents are capable of educating their kids, just like all parents aren't capable of being doctors to their kids or t-ball coaches or whatever it is that kids need. Parents can't provide everything. I think some parents can, and if they should, go for it, and it's probably better than the teacher could do. But I'm also sensitive to the government. Why is the government in there doing it? I'm personally so cynical that I think if the government didn't do it, it wouldn't happen. I know we say, but we're charitable, we're giving. Like I'm just not seeing it. I think people have their own things to they have their own finances to worry about, and I think taxes and a public school system in this situation is a kind of the price you have to pay to live in a society that's bound together and helps everybody out to make everybody better, which is very commie sounding but also very liberal.
So we're going with taxes are the price of civilization argument.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go with that.
Okay.
Jeremy?
I still disagree that her comments that they know what's best for children is wrong.
Can know what's best. I think they're professionals like any other professional, just like a dentist would know what's best for your teeth.
Yeah.
You know, or the
but
mouse
they guys. They don't examine everybody, every student on the level that a dentist examines a patient's teeth.
Right. I'm with you there.
They want to plant this formula down and say, this is what's best for your child because your child is 8 years old and goes to this school.
Right. Well, and plus you have the option of not going to the dentist.
Right. Yes. Or not paying for the dentist. Right.
You don't have the option of not going to school.
You have the option of not going to public school, but you still got to pay for it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I'm just saying don't – I understand that the teaching practices could be bad and you can get your bad teachers, but don't disparage the field, I guess. Or maybe you can disparage the field. That's a whole separate conversation, whether the field is even doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Right.
Which I'm not sure it is, but I'm talking more in a theoretical sense.
Well, I guess, you summed up my response pretty well, but I would say that, you know, nobody is obligated to save, whatever that means, to save these kids. You know, are we saving them from what? From their parents? You know, are their parents abusing them by not giving them a proper education? Is that what we're saying? Or are we saving these kids from their, you know, their ultimate fate of being, you know, what, poor or lower status or, you know, I'm not sure what we're saving them from. But the fact is that, you know, we have kids now that are in those situations even after going through the public education system. So I'm not sure you can make the argument that, you know, it's this safety net.
Right.
There are still kids, plenty of kids falling through that net. So,
and there are kids who go to private school who need to be saved as well because of, you know, some people just,
right.
They're going to end up a certain way. And
he said that. And he said that there are kids that are going to go down the wrong path. You can't do anything about that.
Yep.
But
let me state that I'm not against public school. I need to make that clear.
Okay. Well, let me state that I am against public school.
Yes.
Make that clear.
Yes. I think it needs some fixing, but.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on here. Listener Nathan had this to say. This is actually a comment on episode 18, which we did. We talked about gold and the economy. And Nathan had this to say. You claim that FDR's purported reason for outlawing gold ownership was to fix the economy. I would suggest that the banksters had planned the end of the use of gold to back the monetary unit from the very beginning of the Federal Reserve, as the end of the gold standard would inevitably be required with a monetary unit that could be issued by the stroke of a pen. The banksters had planned this and failed multiple times before. They used the planned economic problems caused by the Federal Reserve as an excuse to steal the gold from the people. I just thought that was an interesting point, but, you know, I can see that you know, without calling that a full-blown conspiracy theory, I could see that, you know, just normal economic forces, you know, market forces would drive certain banks to kind of, you know, collude into doing something like that.
It wasn't the first step really fractional reserve?
I don't know. I mean, did you have fractional reserve before? Yeah, I guess you did, because that was kind of what necessitated the FDIC.
Yep.
Because the banks were loaning out way more money than they had.
Yes.
Nathan also provided some links to a site called Shadow Stats that I'll put in the show notes. And this is a site that kind of addresses one of the issues that we brought up in episode 18 about how the government is no longer publishing all of the data that they used to. And this is true for areas other than just money supply. It has to do with unemployment and inflation and other things. So anyway, this site has compiled what they claim to be the true data, and I don't know. We'll leave that as an exercise for the listeners to determine for themselves whether it's true or not. Let's see, on episode 19, Nathan had this to say. He says somebody said, this might have been Rob, who said inner city schools where the budgets are even tighter. I don't know. I don't remember which one of us said that.
Sounds like something I'd say.
It was Rob.
Nathan says, I've always been curious about the origins of that myth. The Center for American Progress released a report last year that is interesting. They even made a handy-dandy interactive map. And he's got the link there. I'll put that in the show notes. Check out Missouri. St. Louis City is the 17th highest per pupil spender, assuming you trust their methodology, out of 340 districts with 250 or more pupils. I don't have the references to back it up, but I know that as little as 10 years ago, St. Louis City, in fact, was the highest in the state for per pupil expenditures. And he has a footnote here that says, Rob could trust their methodology since the organization has progress in its name.
Yes. Yes. Doesn't say founders or heritage. It must be true.
I'm not sure the expenditures, the 14,000 versus 9,000, I don't know that that negates Rob's statement, though. I mean, if their education model requires that it costs $14,000 per pupil, then that doesn't mean they have that money, or that yeah, we have plenty of money. Let's go spend 14 grand.
Okay. I guess you're looking at the actual data. I didn't go that far.
No, I'm just looking at what's in his comment right here. $14,353 per pupil versus CAPS.
Seeing the website, I guess the data that's recorded there for St. Louis City. It says adjusted per pupil spending $9,488, and that is 18th in the state. So there's only 17 districts that spend more per pupil than St. Louis City, out of 340.
See, tops.
Okay.
So,
but how?
So what he's saying is Rob's claim that the budgets are tight in the inner city schools, at least in St. Louis City, that's perhaps not the case.
Right. Poorly phrased.
I understand what he's saying, but I'm saying I don't know that that's an argument to say the budgets aren't tight.
You're saying that. Even though they're spending $9,000 per pupil, that really maybe they need $18,000 per pupil to do a good job.
Yes, or they only have $8,000 to spend.
Oh no, I think
there's deficit spending. Or I'm not saying there is. I'm just saying I don't think the numbers there necessarily mean their budgets aren't tight. Just because they happen to be the 17th highest spending district.
Well, then that would mean that everybody's budget is tight, right?
Maybe. I guess it does.
But what does that mean, that the budget's tight? I mean, it means you can't gold plate your toilets, but does it mean that you're not?
But don't schools generally spend, or don't government entities make their budgets tight? Because if they don't, then money gets
taken away.
That's taken away. Right. So. Yeah. You're going to spend as much as you have allocated.
They had a $10 million surplus every year. Sooner or later, somebody's going to take that away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. So maybe they are tight, but it's by design. All right. Well, you guys got anything else?
Well, I was just going to clarify that Nathan made the statement on Jeremy's support of anti-drug laws because those people may violate other people's rights. I don't support anti-drug laws, and I didn't say that I supported anti-drug laws. I initially, what he's referencing here is that I said I partially disagreed with something Jerry said regarding drugs being outlawed, but I don't support anti-drug laws, and I guess that's all I have to say about that, to quote Forrest Gump.
Oh, Forrest. All right. I guess that about wraps it up.
Yeah, and if any of our listeners get caught on any kind of drug charges and you say you listened to the podcast and they said it was all okay, we don't know what you're talking about.
That's right. We don't know who you are.
And I hope our houses don't get raided because they think we're all trafficking or...
Well, Rob have drugs. A pothead. I mean, come on now.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's clear.
He was token while we were recording here, I'm sure.
It's made me the man I am today.
Oh, what an indictment of drug use.
That by itself is enough to make everybody want to stop. Okay, let me say again, welcome to our new fans, and thanks for listening. Leave us some feedback on Facebook or send us an email, feedback@MidwestPeaceProcess.com, and also visit iTunes and give us some love. And I guess we will see you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Good night.
Bye now.
What are the big round numbers or the findings of the war on drugs? What has it been doing, and what has it been, how has it been affecting American society?
When we first started the war on drugs, we only had a few hundred thousand people in prison. Today, we're somewhere around 2.5 million people in prison. Over those 40 years, we've put over 39 million people in prison, and a vast majority of those are from nonviolent drug offenses.
Cost, so that's things like simple possession, yeah, or low-level dealing.
Low-level dealing, like, yeah, right. We're not talking about kingpins, right, and even though we've arrested a few. We're looking at $1.3 trillion spent on law enforcement efforts. We're talking about cops, judges, judicial system, and prisons. That's quite costly. When you look at the number of bodies, look at Mexico. Over the past 5 years alone, since we've stepped up efforts in assisting Mexico in fighting back against the cartel, you're looking at over, I think the number's like 38,000 people murdered at the hands of the cartel. In Venezuela, it's even more. In our very own country, in our neighborhoods and in our communities, every year, somewhere between 5,000 to 8,000 people murdered at the hands of our neighborhood gangs.
Why do police chiefs push back against the drug war as it's currently constituted? What's it doing to their efforts to actually control crime?
You have to think about the history of how local police got involved in this in the first place. It came from the federal government in the form of funding. We bribed in getting into this war. Many police agencies now continue to balance their budgets through federal funds, through grants, burn grants, and what have you. And to lose that money would be significant.